don't be afraid of what's going to happen, right? 100 people might say no, but it's all about the one yes. It's all about the one yes. If you can get the one yes, that's going to transact into something bigger, something more meaningful to you and whoever else you align yourselves with at large.
Welcome to the Real Estate Monopoly Podcast. My name is Kerwin Donis. My brothers and I got into real estate investing to achieve financial freedom and help underserved communities in Guatemala, where our mom is from. Real estate is the vehicle we're taking to achieve our goals, and you can too. On this show, we share the stories of some of the most successful real estate investors to show you that you can succeed in real estate just like they have. Each episode, we deliver inspiring and educational content that will empower you to launch your real estate investing career and achieve your financial goals. Let's go. Hirsch Rai is one of two principals at Rai Vu. As a principal, he oversees all business processes and handlings of the firm with a focus on acquisitions and investor relations. As an active investor, Hirsch heavily invests in commercial multifamily assets, manufactured housing communities, and short-term rental portfolios across the Midwest and Southeast. With any investment, he hopes to improve the quality of life of his residents, provide favorable returns for his investors, and continue to work alongside experienced professionals who share similar visions. Beyond real estate investing, Hirsch is an active duty naval officer who specializes in meteorology and oceanography. Hirsch is currently serving at the Joint Typhoon Warning Center based out of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. He holds a dual BS in computer science and information technology from the U.S. Naval Academy. In addition, he holds an MS in computer and information technology from Purdue University. Hirsch was a graduate student when he first started to submerge himself in real estate content. Once he decided to take action, he found a partner and began looking for opportunities.
I am a active duty naval officer currently stationed out of Hawaii. I do real estate investing on the side, and my journey really started about 2 years ago. I was in graduate school following my graduation from the Naval Academy over at Purdue University in the Midwest. And, you know, I started to listen to a lot of different podcasts, specifically Bigger Pockets, and starting to learn a lot of the books that David Green and Brandon Turner put out with basic single family type investing. And they kept on alluding to two specific markets. The Midwest and the Southeast is really where they do a majority of their investing. So being in the Midwest, I decided, hey, I don't have much money, but I have some money that I can put towards a house. Let me go find a partner who is Nicholas Vu. He's my full-time partner now. He's also active duty Navy, Naval Academy guy, went to Purdue with me, and he's down at flight school in Pensacola. And we decided, hey, let's start looking at student rentals. And we started to look, and that's at the point where the market was pretty hot. I mean, you're talking about, you know, late 2019, pre-COVID. Rates are still a little low, not compared to what they are now, but, you know, you're still at a point where you're still able to afford something with a pretty low return. But, you know, prices are inflated, especially with a Big Ten school with 45,000 people. So we decided to make a transition. We had started to go to a lot of different meetups, learning about multifamily joint ventures, syndications. And we decided to start connecting with people who were doing it in the space. And, you know, we started to add value to them by, you know, doing cold calling for them, direct mail campaigns, assisting with their website development. I have a background in tech. Nick has a background in engineering. So we started to develop underwriting type tools and resources that we could use to really hone in and learn the business. And we finally closed in our first property of February of this year. And ever since, we've closed about four more since then. And that's where we're at.
Hirsch had heard of other kinds of investments before learning about real estate. His interest in real estate was sparked when he was exposed to the benefits of investing in hard assets rather than other intangible assets.
I am full-time in the military. It is a very demanding job, a lot of hours put in, but it's a very rewarding job. I love what I do and I love who I serve. What really got me interested in real estate was being able to utilize an investment tool that's outside of the traditional means, right? Outside of your traditional retirement plan or outside of your traditional ETF or stocks, bonds type options, right? And real estate always honed in with me at some point after reading all these books. I just found that real estate was a tangible asset that promissory notes are based on, tax liens are based on, CMBS type debt is based on, right? You know, buying those mortgage-backed securities. So real estate was always something that stuck out to me. I have family that has done it, you know, for the past couple of years. And so that's really what piqued my interest. And from there, I just started to learn about the massive tax savings that are possible, the way that you can leverage OPM, other people's money, and, you know, being able to do these ventures with smart, like-minded individuals who are willing to put their best foot forward. And that's really why I decided to leverage the real estate space.
There's a common misconception that only wealthy, rich people can get into real estate. I believed this for some time as well, and so did Hirsch. However, by educating himself, he learned that real estate was something anyone can get into with the right drive and mindset.
I think the first time I had ever looked at real estate, I was thinking, you need a lot of money to do this. You know, at least in my direct family, I have a lot of, you know, people who are in, you know, the healthcare field, doctors, you have people who are attorneys, you know, just people who are in your direct vicinity who you see reinvesting in real estate, but they're usually people of high net worth, right? Individuals who make an excess amount of money every year where they're able to invest into different asset classes and different types. And to me, that seemed a bit far-fetched. But as I started to learn more about, you know, more middle-class type folk being able to invest in real estate, build out their portfolio while still maintaining a job that they may love, or being full-time real estate investors, it really got me thinking like, wait, I can do this too. And I started to connect with people, you know, our age in their, you know, lower 20s, mid-20s, even people who are in their upper teens who are doing this thing full-time or just on the active side. And that's really what got me going. That's really what got me pumped up, seeing peers being able to do it. And now I've been able to share my story with so many other people who have started that journey because of, you know, who I learned from and being able to pay it forward.
It was through a desire to have a broad understanding of various asset classes that drove Hirsch into the multifamily space. Once he started to connect with other multifamily real estate investors, he saw what was possible and launched into the multifamily space.
The multifamily space really started back when we were synonymously looking at that student rental portfolio. We had decided between Nick and I, my partner, that we really need to be all-encompassing. We need to understand different asset classes and what value they bring within the real estate space. So whether you're looking at retail office space, or you're looking at multifamily, you're looking at manufactured housing, you're looking at self-storage, at some point or another, the numbers are very correlated between every asset class, right? Once you look at one, you can learn another pretty quickly, as long as you have the proper mentorship and partnerships in that space that you can develop and foresee future business with, excuse me. So I think our multifamily journey really started when we started to reach out to operators in the space and just being in meetups, especially in Indianapolis, Cincinnati, where we had driven to go meet with these investors and just learn about their journey, their craft, and asking how we can contribute. You know, rather than, you know, the common phrase of adding value, it's, you know, how can I solve your biggest challenge? How can I be an asset to you versus a liability? And I think that's really what allowed me to get my foot in the door, as well as my partner, to be able to consistently, you know, solve people's problems for them, add value. I know I just said, you know, not to say that, but, you know, at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to, right? Being able to be a proponent for others as well as an advocate for yourself. You know, once you do something for L, you can't just be give, give, give. It also, you know, needs to be a give and take balanced relationship. And the multifamily was just something that really struck out with us. We really believed in the asset class, as most people do nowadays. And, you know, being in the military, we move around a lot. So, you know, buying something that has 20 units in one place versus, you know, 20 units scattered around a huge MSA is extremely management intensive versus what it might be for that consolidated multifamily asset class. So that's really what brought us over there and what really we decided to look at.
By sharing a military background with other multifamily investors, Hirsch and his partner were able to build connections with a particular team. Through this relationship, Hirsch learned about underwriting and got hands-on experience as a multifamily investor.
Since we joined that team, we've actually spun off and we've made our own investment firm. So I will allude that. But the reason we had got connected was just due to a common military background. There are a lot of great stories out there of people who served, veterans who have given so much for this country and are doing the same by providing quality, affordable housing to people in these types of neighborhoods living in a B or C class neighborhood. And we just started to reach out to a lot of these types of investors, and we were able to connect with them on a level that, you know, maybe a non-military person might not understand. And, you know, there's a common level of trust and decency that goes with that relationship. We were able to carry that, learn about their business. They had felt like we had some value to add to them. And they said, hey, how do you guys feel about underwriting? We said, hey, we don't know much about it, but we'd love to learn more about it and tell us what you know. And we started to learn from them about their craft. We started to look at deals for them. They would correct us. And then we got, you know, I'd say pretty good at it. We'll be able to basically turn around a property within 4 to 6 hours or less. I mean, that's with some waiting time in between looking at the email and things. And we were able to transact on that and be a part of a great team. So I would say it's that military connection, opening up the way to opening up a door for us in order to break into the industry. And I think that's something super important that I want to touch on, Kerwin, is, you know, a lot of people are trying to break into the industry. And, you know, I've been in a podcast with Jerome Myers. I'm not sure if you've heard of his multifamily missteps, but he comes down to saying it's up down to four things, right? Knowledge, capital, deal flow, experience, right? And, you know, where can I contribute the most is that deal flow, that acquisitions pipeline of, you know, how can I find the deal? How can I source the deal? How can I underwrite the deal? Do I have relationships in place to ready to, you know, finance the deal, go inspect the deal, go find the insurance for the deal? So, you know, we had started with that and we've built our relationships through that ever since to be able to transact to what we've done today.
Direct-to-seller marketing can be effective in multifamily real estate, depending on the unit size. Hirsch found a deal through this strategy, but things didn't go as planned. However, he found his first multifamily deal shortly after.
So we had done a lot of off-market direct-to-seller type work last year, especially during COVID. There were a lot of people who were feeling the after effects. You know, the forbearance was getting lifted at points, but the eviction moratorium held firm all throughout 2020. So you had a lot of owners who were like, I don't know what's going to happen. Is there going to be a downturn? Is the government not going to keep pumping money into, you know, rent assistance, things like that? And we had actually put one property under contract last year of about August of last year. And we had actually pulled out of that deal because the owner had lied to us. You know, we had felt like that was going to be our first deal. But unfortunately, there were a lot of problems, drug infused problems and things of that sort with the clientele. So we decided to pull out. You know, after months of, you know, being proactive, it turns out one of our peers, he's a 25-year-old investor out of Indianapolis, along with his colleague, another 25-year-old investor out of Indy who now moved to Michigan, brought us a deal. They said, hey, look, this is one of the largest properties that we've come across. We're not willing to buy it ourselves because they usually, you know, anything that comes across their desk, they like to buy for themselves. It was a little too big at the time for them. So they said, hey, we know you guys have been trying to break in. You know, we know you guys like the indie market, and we dove in. So, you know, we bought a 16-unit C-class apartment complex in an A-class neighborhood. So it's 25 minutes out of Indianapolis in the town of Avon, Indiana. It is an A-class neighborhood. And why I say that is because, you know, the average rent for a two-bedroom over there is like $1,400. Okay. This is the Midwest we're talking about, folks. So, you know, you're talking about a place that's pretty affluent for what you might compare it to. I mean, this isn't downtown. It's just 25 minutes in a pretty working, a lot of suburbs, a lot of people who work in the city and come back. Yeah. And so, like I said, it was 16 doors. We bought it in February of this year. That was a traditional joint venture. There's five partners on the deal between Nick, myself, and three other partners on that deal. We are involved on the acquisition side as well as the day-to-day operations, as every partner is with an active joint venture. And we've actually had pretty good success. We've been able to renovate a handful of the units thus far, achieving rent bumps of about $300 to $400, depending on the type of unit. Great location, great asset, and definitely something that we plan to keep long-term here if we can.
Multifamily investors are expected to deal with both expected and unexpected challenges that arise during a hold period. And they will come. Hirsch experienced this firsthand on his first multifamily deal.
Every deal has its challenges, right? Not everything comes according to the pro forma that you draw up, Kerwin. I'm sure you know that, or you're going to know that with your first deal here pretty soon. But what I would say is the business plan was a five-year hold. We had planned to essentially just do renovations and turn over units about, you know, four a year. We've been a lot more aggressive than that. I mean, we're conservative on underwriting, but we figured it's our first deal. You know, we have contractors, but they're backed up. Everyone was trying to do the DIY or have contractors come to their home and do the work for them with COVID, just because they wanted to feel more comfortable at home, which is totally understandable. We've been able to actually beat out that business plan, but I will say we have turned over our property manager. The first property manager that we had was very inefficient at communicating. They were non-effective. And the one representative that we liked at the company ended up leaving due to the frustrations with inside the organization itself. So we have had a transition with the property manager. Other than that, things have been going pretty well. There was some disparity at the beginning in terms of being able to get the funds from the bank in order to pay the contractors. We did take out a loan in conjunction with the property to pay for those renovations. But I think the business plan has since shifted, actually, you know, think on your feet. We're looking to complete the whole renovation cycle by February of next year, a little bit later, in that 12-month IO period that we're currently under with the bank that we are using, and do a refinance into either a SBL, Fannie Mae type loan with agency long-term debt, or we might sell. So who knows? We're looking at a lot of different options. I personally would like to refinance, but some of the other partners may feel differently. So we're all just, it's a fluid decision, and we'll wait to see what happens next year.
The team is the most important part of any multifamily deal. Hirsch's team has multiple members, and accountability plays a major role in how they operate efficiently.
There's a weekly meeting that's held between all the partners. There's a monthly one for the partners who are a little bit more oversee the larger decision-making per se. You know, some of these guys have extremely active jobs outside of real estate that they might not be able to make those day-to-day decisions. So, you know, there's a weekly meeting with the representative over at the property management team to discern, hey, what are the pros? What are the cons for this week? What can we improve on? And what are we doing well? You know, looking at the finances, seeing, you know, what's coming in, what's going out, that things of that sort. In terms of roles, I, along with Nick and one other partner, are pretty active in the operations of dealing with the property manager. But there is one individual who's not of those three who is, you know, having that day-to-day, you know, hourly communication with the property manager, texting them, making sure that they're taken care of. Hey, there's a tenant who needs this, or hey, there's something that needs that. But you know, the transition to this new property manager isn't great. We haven't had really any direct interaction with the tenants since then, which has been really, really nice. And it keeps me sleeping at night thus far. But I would say, you know, the roles are pretty generalized for this type of property, just because everyone essentially knows, you know, what they need to do and how they need to do it. And if someone doesn't pick up the slack in one area, then, you know, someone else comes in for that day. So we're not necessarily, you know, hey, this guy only needs to focus on renovations. You know, it's like a give and take type relationship, like I talked about. And that's extremely important in a joint venture, I would say.
On his first deal, Hirsch and his partners opted to joint venture on the deal rather than syndicate it. It made more sense than a syndication because it wasn't too large of a property. It's important to keep in mind the pros and cons of a joint venture, but for Hirsch, the pros of a joint venture outweighed any cons.
The way we looked at it was, you know, it was $1 million purchase price, about $62,500 a door. You know, it's a small deal. It wasn't anything that really needed to be syndicated for that deal amount. Some people do syndicate those smaller deals, and, you know, I applaud them for doing that. They're making investment opportunities for that smaller group of investors. I'm guessing they would do a 506B on it. But, you know, we had the investors who had the money ready. We had some money ready as well. We were able to align ourselves alongside our investors who came in on that deal with these active operators. So that's essentially why we decided to do a joint venture versus syndication. The pros, I would say, of a joint venture are three things. One, everyone has an active invested interest in the property, you know, in conjunction with their capital contributed, as well as the amount of effort that they're putting in, right? So that's one. Two, I would say, is the legal fees are a lot less, right? You're just drafting a simple organization entity instantiation, as well as the operating agreement to solidify that investment opportunity. So there's less legal costs. And then three, you know, everyone knows what's happening with the property on a day-to-day basis, right? Everyone is informed. Everyone has their questions answered, and everyone has access to the same amount of material and knowledge, right? So there's a degree of transparency there that's involved with those joint venture type of operations. And everyone's educated on that role and what their the asset class that they're investing in is. For syndication, I would say, you know, the pros are, you know, the active operators maintain full control, and the passive investors, just wait for that rental check to come in the mail, right? Wait for that passive income, that mailbox money. But I would say that at points you will have some inexperienced investors, and, you know, we really try to educate people as best as we can. We refer them to podcasts that we've been on, such as this one. We have an ebook that we wrote. And there's a lot of different podcasts aside from the ones that we've been on that we recommend to, you know, passive investors who want to learn more about the space. As well as syndication, you know, it is a lot more paperwork, a lot more diligence in, you know, identifying partners, whether they're accredited or not. So, I mean, it takes a little bit more work, but at the end of the day, I think it depends on, you know, do you want more of an active role along active investors? And one, and then two, you know, what's the deal size? Do you actually have that amount of capital to take down that big of a deal or not? That's what I would say.
As you mentioned early on in our conversation, Hirsch almost closed on another deal prior to this actual first one. This one had an interesting seller, and in that case, the seller presented him with financials on a napkin.
Throwback to June of 2020, okay? So we're talking Q2 2020. We are doing a cold call campaign focused on Indianapolis and the greater submarket. And we called an owner about 35 minutes south of the main city lines in Martinsville, Indiana. So this is city southwest, pretty C-class type neighborhood, working folk in Indiana. And, you know, we had decided, he said he was open to selling. We said, okay, you know, we would like to meet you. So we decided to drive down one day from West Lafayette. It took about 2 hours. We made our way down and, you know, we get there. The community is pretty disheveled. There's a lot of, debris all over the place. Just very, it's not necessarily the place that I would go live. It's a distressed property, right? You have people who don't necessarily look like they're in the best health or the best condition. The owner is not extremely vested into the property itself. It's more of a slumlord type operation, and we can clearly see that. So we're seeing a lot of value to be had. You know, we explored the greater area a little bit. And as we were walking through, you know, the owner, as well as his brother was there too, who had a vested interest in the property. We're explaining, hey, you know, this is what the property is. This is what we've been done to it. This is what we're planning to do with it. And, you know, unfortunately they were not giving us access to any of the inside of the units. You know, although some of them were vacant, they said, no, we're not going to show you the insides. And I think there was some degree there that we should have probably foreseen at that point. Maybe we should have asked for a follow-up walkthrough with one of our more experienced partners who are looking to partner with us on the deal. But, you know, we were pretty gung-ho. So we said, hey, this is the property. This is what the underwriting looks like. We've been through it. Here are the pictures. None of the interior, mind you. And, you know, we decided to move forward. You know, as we were leaving, we asked for some financials and, you know, they gave us some really, really disheveled P&L for 12 months or a T12. But it was not the best accounting. There were a lot of missing expenses. There were coffee stains on it. And we had asked for a rent roll and the guy's like, oh yeah, wait, let me get that for you. He comes out of his car and he pulls out this, you know, notebook paper that looked like it had been used as, you know, toilet paper, honestly, essentially. And it was just, you know, everyone's name, whose rent had been collected. And, you know, there was no structure, no process that was given to extremely poor financials, essentially, at the end of the day. And, you know, we decided to move forward. We saw a degree of sophistication that we could add, you know, add that value to a mom and pop type owner. As we started to undergo inspection periods, you know, following a long PSA negotiation process in September of last year, we had found out that there were actually a drug lab that had been in one of the units and hadn't been cleaned out a few years prior, yet there was an individual living in it, which was against Indiana state code and law. The owner had lied about a lot of the CapEx that he had proclaimed he had done, but you know, roofs were falling apart, HVAC systems weren't working, air conditioners were just not there. You know, a lot of different things that we hadn't foreseen going into the property. And, you know, just so happens while we were under contract, one of the units caught on fire. So, you know, just very random things that were happening. And we decided to pull out. Luckily, we had framed it where we were to be reimbursed for any earnest money due. So none of the money went hard. And it was a good learning experience, right? You know, make sure you do a little bit more diligence before you double down on a property. You know, we felt pretty comfortable going into the contract just because there was no earnest money up front. The inspection period was pretty long and we hadn't felt like there was going to be much at-risk capital put up except for the one physical inspection that we had done. And, you know, having our partners come out, we had one come out from Cali, one from Indy, one from Colorado, not from Indy, from Pennsylvania, the one from Colorado to come tour it with us. And we had decided at that point, yeah, this is not happening. I remember one of the partners saying, as we were standing right there on day one, this isn't happening. And I said, yeah, you're probably right. But, you know, hey, this is a good learning experience. It was our first time doing formal walkthroughs, being able to talk with inspectors and, you know, really learning the ins and outs of what to look for in a physical inspection. So it was definitely a good learning opportunity.
Although that deal didn't work out, there were many learning lessons for Hirsch from that experience. Now, he does more due diligence to vet a property, and he gets input from other credible parties when he's assessing a property's potential.
right now, I'd say anything that I do direct to seller, I need to at least have me or a trusted representative in my network, whether it's a partner, whether it's a boots on the ground type property manager, agent, attorney. I've had attorneys agree to go look at properties for me. That's the only reason I say that. And if you find one that does that for you, keep them, by the way. But I would say, like, always have someone that you can have as a voice of reason for you, you know, because you might say the property looks great on the numbers, but if you have a guy who goes, I mean, first of all, Google Maps tells you great things, but it doesn't tell you everything, right? So if you have a person, individual, guy, gal, whatever, go and look at the property and they say, oh, like, you know, the property might look good for the numbers, but like, hey, like, here's the X, Y, and Z of why you should not buy this. Well, great. You know, then we're not going to go put it under contract, or we're not going to, you know, go put the effort forward to go contact our attorney and say, hey, can you draft the PSA? Can you start the title work? Can we start contacting our mortgage brokers over in whatever market that we're focusing on to start going and looking at financing options, right? I mean, for example, we had another property we were looking at in Gulfport, Mississippi, which is actually where I am right now. And I will tell you, now that I'm here in this market, I most likely will not buy here ever. But, you know, I was in Hawaii at the time. This is probably 3 or 4 months ago. And one of our partners said, hey, we should go look and buy this, you know, the 16 unit of complex. I said, okay, you know, pretty attractive price tag, about 600,000. And, you know, we had decided to put it under contract because one of our property managers said, hey, that's a really good price. You should go for it. Once she walked through the property, and again, we had made sure that it was fully earnest money, full earnest money paid back. But this time we didn't do the inspection. We said, hey, let's go do a walkthrough with the broker and the property manager and the owner. The property manager came back and she was like, absolutely cut the contract right now. You're not buying it. It's not a worthwhile deal. And at that point we said, hey, we're cutting out of the deal. Please sign the release of the earnest money. And we cut the contract right there. So like, that's the type of, you know, those are the types of things we learned about. You know, even though we were in the market in Indianapolis, we were still newbie investors who, you know, we're still learning the craft. And, you know, now we've walked a good amount of properties, especially with experienced operators, we've been able to learn about, you know, what to look for, or also, you know, the questions to ask up front to those brokers, to those owners, to get a better sense of the property and what it looks like. And, you know, again, if you have an owner who lies to you, well, make sure you have the outs of a on a clause to make sure you can settle legally and make sure that you're not harmed in any way.
An investor's background contributes to the grit and resilience they have when it comes to the ups and downs of real estate investing. Hirsch's unique background has prepared him for the obstacles he's faced in real estate and has contributed to the success he has reached and will reach in the future.
So one thing to know about Raivu, I'm an Indian immigrant, first generation. My parents came over when I was 4 months old back in 1997. And my business partner is actually Vietnamese American. Okay. He's also first generation. His parents had come over from Vietnam. So, you know, there's a synergy between Nick and I, for sure, about how we see how many opportunities this country has given us. There's a reason we would decided to serve, to give back to this country that's given us so much. And there's a proponent to that of, you know, being at the age I am and being able to invest in real estate and provide these types of returns to, you know, investors of all backgrounds and walks of life, as well as, you know, the residents who live there. It's been an extremely rewarding experience being able to interact with tenants when I can, and being able to go visit these properties, oversee these properties, build substantial relationships with, you know, anyone I can, whether they're active partners, passive partners, and being able to pay it forward. And I'd say the largest thing out of my immigrant background that's helped me succeed is, you know, my parents always said, don't ever take an opportunity and let it go to waste. Essentially, don't ever take anything for granted. And those words have stuck with me ever since I was a little child, right? You have a lot of people in this country who love what they do and do what they love, but you also have some people who are still learning. I'm not going to say that they've completely squandered away, but they're still learning where to find themselves and, you know, how to be the best version of themselves possible. And, you know, I feel like real estate, investing, the military, the United States in general has really given me all those opportunities to provide for, you know, myself, my family, and, you know, potentially give back to the greater community, the greater organization at large, and, you know, give back as much as I can. And I'm just so thankful for everything that has been done. And, you know, shout out to my mom and dad in this podcast. Love you guys. You guys have done so much for me, as well as my brother. He's also at the Naval Academy right now. So, you know, service runs through the family at this point. And, you know, we just continue to grow and learn to love what we do and live what we do. So,
although wealth is a common byproduct of a real estate investor's career, for Hirsch, giving back is more important. He's doing that by serving his residents and his fellow citizens.
I think wealth follows those who give back and are helpful. You know, I have always been one to, you know, go volunteer in my local community. I used to go volunteer at the local hospital. in my community back in New Hampshire where I grew up. When I got to graduate school, I did a lot of work at the local hospital as well. There's a trend here, as you can see. But I'd say like giving back is one of the most important things to me. And, you know, I'm doing that by, you know, leading a life of service for now and being able to do these types of things. But I'd say the biggest proponent for me was two things. One, giving back, and two, being able to learn a business and being able to apply it in my everyday life. Taking those values of, you know, a growth mindset, taking those values of learning, loving, caring, and applying it to, you know, the sailors that I lead every day, or, you know, the business that I am building right now, or, you know, the everyday organization that I support, that is the United States Navy, right? There's so many different ways that real estate can teach you about all these fundamental life lessons, aside from what you might not learn in school, and being able to employ them on your everyday lifestyle and your skill set. And that's one of the, those are the two biggest proponents. Those are the two biggest proponents, I would say, of why I love doing what I do.
Failure is something everyone encounters. Especially as an entrepreneur, we have an opportunity to fail every day. Hirsch understands this and sees these moments as a chance to improve and grow.
There are failures every day. You know, whether it's you miss an email, you miss a meeting, you forget that you need to go submit an earnest money deposit check, you're not in, you know, contract timeline. I mean, there's so many different things that you could be improving on each day. And I think what it comes down to is taking all those as a learning opportunity rather than marking them as failures, right? You know, take the 5 minutes that you need to say, you know, mope around. But after that, you know, really build yourself up and say, no, like, this is a learning opportunity. It's not going to happen again. And if you let it happen again, ask yourself why. What slipped through the cracks? Do you need assistance? It'd be okay to ask for help. And I'd say the biggest failure so far is not knowing when to ask for help. You know, I think, you know, initially Nick and I thought we could do this all alone, right? We had said, you know, this is what we can do. This is how we do it. We don't really need any external influences or any external motivators to be able to get us to where we want to go. And quickly we realized that real estate is an extremely pivotable type business, right? You need to be able to pivot at a moment's notice. You know, like I said, if a property manager is not communicating with you, if a property is found to have $150,000 worth of damage, or if a property decides to go up in flames while you're under contract, right? There's so many different ways that you need to be able to ask for help when you need it. And I cannot emphasize that enough. And I think that's something we've learned. And that's why we've learned, lean so much on our partners to be able to invest in us as well as invest in our, you know, invest in them by being able to build that relationship and grow our relationship with them through that.
For Hirsch, success is measured based on impact and happiness. Through his portfolio, he's succeeding in providing his residents with a great property to live in, and he's dedicated himself to keeping his partners, residents, and the people he surrounded himself with happy.
I think success is measured in two ways. One, how are you impacting the local community? Two, are you able to meet the happiness factor for your investors, for your partners, for your residents, as well as yourself? Okay, those are the two main things I would say. And I think right now we're doing a great job, right? I mean, we've already transacted about 4 commercial deals. We've done a couple smaller short-term rentals that we're burring right now, Burr B&B. And I'd say the best thing right now is just being able to, you know, give back to the community as much as we can, right? Being able to provide them a cleaner, affordable place to live compared to previous ownership. Some of them were left in great shape, but, you know, we want to improve where it was left off, right? Continue to set the bar as you move forward. So that's one. And two, you know, being able to align yourselves with the people that are living in your properties, as well as, like I said, your investors, your partners, as well as yourselves. If you yourself are not happy, what's to say that the people that you're involving yourself with are as well? So it's by keeping those people happy and keeping them informed, keeping being transparent, keeping an honest relationship stands for a healthy and happy relationship. And those are the two main things I would say. And, you know, where we have some really exciting projects in the pipeline. We're working on a new development down in Florida and a couple other projects that I can't disclose right now, but, you know, excited to share in the future. So I'd say, you know, onward and upward from here, and we're really excited for what comes next.
Long-term, Hirsch aims to grow his business and move into the private equity space. Through this initiative, he plans on expanding his horizons beyond multifamily into different asset classes and other industries.
I ask myself that every day. I wake up and I say, all right, how can we improve the business on the daily front? And I'd say long-term goal, long-term vision is to really, you know, grow this company aside from a real estate based private equity firm. We have some great partners and, you know, there are discussions of potentially combining synergies and, you know, making something of a Blackstone type venture where, you know, you have the real estate as your main proponent, but, you know, we would love to do leverage buyouts, buy businesses, flip businesses, and maybe do some acquisition type work, venture capital, private equity into different forays of different asset classes or different business assets, things like that. And, you know, on the shorter scale, I'd say, you know, we want to continue to transact in the mobile home park, manufactured housing space, continue to do development work. We really think that there's a lot of drive and a lot of value creation through development versus the traditional value add. We still love our traditional value add core plus multifamily, but, you know, you've seen how cap rates are getting compressed right now. Mind you, this is September 2021. So that may shift here in about a year or two if people are listening to this podcast then. But, you know, as of now, it's focusing on asset classes that people may not know about and providing those investment opportunities for them to grow as well alongside us.
Being vulnerable and taking action have had a big impact on Hirsch. By doing these two things, he's been able to start building a real estate portfolio at an age when most people don't even know what a multifamily property is.
Don't be afraid to be vulnerable and start early. And I'd say there's two key components to that, right? Vulnerability and starting early. I cannot tell you how much leverage an individual like Kerwin has, an individual like I do, with being young, okay? Being young, being ambitious. You go on LinkedIn and you send a message to a CEO, they're going to most likely read your message because they see a younger guy who's behind the keyboard, who's behind the profile. And whether they respond to you or not, it might have left an impression with them. I will not lie to you. I've cold messaged tons of people on LinkedIn asking them about their business, about their background, why they're doing what they're doing, whether they're veterans, whether they're real estate operators, whether they're private equity type individuals, whether they're just business execs or people who just have a knack for business development, or people even in academia when I was doing my graduate work at Purdue, right? It's being able to connect with these people on a different level and learning about what they do. And at some point, your big break is going to come. I don't call it a big break for a reason. What I mean by that is it's your foot in the door to be able to expand and, you know, offer opportunities to people who may be looking for that foot in the door, being that person that you can pay it back to 10, 20, 30 months down the line, or whether it's years down the line. And that's what I would say, right? Start early. And the other thing is be vulnerable. Like, don't be afraid of what's going to happen, right? 100 people might say no, but it's still all about the one yes. It's all about the one yes. If you can get the one yes, that's going to transact into something bigger, something more meaningful to you and your partners and whoever else you align yourselves with at large.
To learn more about Hirsch and follow him on his journey, here's where you can go to find him.
Three ways. One is our website, raivucapital.com, RAIVUCAPITAL.com. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn. It's just Hirsch Rai. I'm the only one, H-E-R-S-H space R-A-I. You will not find another Hirsch Rai on LinkedIn. So you can connect with me there. More than happy to chat. And then you can also reach me via my email. It's just HERSH@RaivuCapital.com.
Thank you for joining us today on the Real Estate Monopoly Podcast. If you got value from this episode, please do us a favor and give us a good rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Make sure to visit our website at www.donisinvestmentgroup.com/monopoly, where you can subscribe to our newsletter so you'll never miss a show. If you want to avoid the top 5 mistakes passive investors make, you can also check out our free ebook by going to www.donisinvestmentgroup.com and downloading it. Be sure to tune into our next episode. Until then, take care, guys.